welcome back. Today we're going to talk about, we're going to have a recap, and then we're going to talk about parallel computers. I would like to start with the halting problem, and just to recap that, before we do clicker questions about it. So here's a script that we took a look at before, and we said that we can start with, this is just an example, right? If we start with the initial value of 10, we repeat until I is 0, we pop, and we change I by minus 1. And so we said that, you know, if we stare at this problem, we can say that it will stop. And, you know, just to show you that it's true. And so you see how the I value changes, right? As the loop goes on, I decreases until it reaches 0, and then it stops. And so if we say that, we said that if we change I to be a negative number in the beginning, what's happening is that it will decrease the I by 1 for the rest of eternity, and it will pop, or until we stop the script. But this script doesn't stop by itself. And so for the initial value of I being a negative number, this will run forever. So another example will be for, let's go back to 10. What if we do this being plus 1, minus 1? So we start with the initial value of I being 10, and we stop when I is 0, and at every step we add 1 to I. What's that going to do? It will run forever, because it can never reach 0. And so it keeps adding, keeps adding, and keeps adding, and never stops. It can never reach the stopping point. Okay. Are there any questions about that? Alright, so let's do some clicker questions. Let's do it.
Chris never got back to me.
Oh, he didn't?
No.
All right.
I was asking this morning.
Okay, maybe he didn't get it or something. Okay, that's the first one. Come and talk to me.
All right.
So... So the question is, you have the script that says when flag is clicked, set count to question mark. This is called a question mark. I know it doesn't look like a question mark. It says repeat until count is bigger than 46. Play sound pop until done. Change count by 1. And the question is, for what values of question mark will the script eventually halt? Yeah. Repeat until count is bigger than 46. Okay? And the options are A, all values, B, all even numbers smaller than 46, C, all even numbers, D, no values, E, all numbers smaller than 46. I know it's hard to see, so if you have questions, let me know. Stop at 2. Let's see.
So the options are, I think, between A and E. Let's see what this does. So the way to think about it is, what happens for numbers that are bigger than 46? Okay, so let's say that count is equal to 48. If this says repeat until count is bigger than 46, and it is. So it stops. So for all numbers that are going to be bigger than 46, this script will halt. So those are good numbers. Now let's see what happens for numbers that are smaller than 46. Let's take 45. Set count to 45 here. Repeat until count is bigger than 46. It's not. Place on top, change count by 1, makes it 46. It's still not bigger, strictly bigger than 46. But the next time it goes through the loop, it's going to make it 47, which will be bigger than 46, and so it'll stop. So for numbers that are bigger than 46, it doesn't even go into the loop. For numbers that are smaller than 46, it goes into the loop. Every time it goes through the loop, it adds 1 to count, and so it'll eventually hit 46, 47, and stop. And so the right answer is all values. Any questions? That's what it is. And eventually is a key word. I don't think you can say very. So you have, when a flag is clicked, set count to question mark, repeat until count is smaller, strictly smaller than 46, play sound pop, change count by 2. And what values of question mark will this script eventually halt? A, all values, B, all even numbers smaller than 46, C, all even numbers, D, no values, E, all numbers smaller than 46. I'll stop at 1:45. What happens for numbers that are smaller than 46? If count starts by being 44, it says repeat until count is smaller than 46, so it stops. It doesn't even go into loop. If a number is bigger than 46, so 48, set count to 48, repeat until count is smaller than 46, goes into the loop, change count by 2, makes it 50. Then the next time, it makes it 52. And so on, it will never reach something that's smaller than 46, and so it will not stop. And so for numbers that are bigger than 46 are not good. Numbers that are smaller than 46 are good. Okay? It's definitely better than the previous. Any questions? This is the last one. Same question. I think the only difference is that there's an equal here.
So set count to question mark, repeat until count is equal to 46. Play sound pop and change count by 2. And you have the same options. The same question and the same options. Stop at 120. Unless people need more time. What happens for numbers that are smaller than 40? Let's take an even number that's smaller than 46. Let's take 40. So what happened was for 40, it went into the loop and it added 2 and made it 42. It went into the loop again and made it 44. Went into the loop again, made it 46, and then stopped. And so it definitely stops for numbers that are even, numbers that are smaller than 46. Let's see what happens for odd numbers that are smaller. 41, 42, 43. So what happens in this case is that it keeps adding 2, and because it keeps adding 2, there's always going to be, the count is always going to be an odd number. And so it can never hit 46. And so it skips over 46, and it keeps adding, and never gets to 46. Okay? Sorry about that. I should have told you that there was going to be popping happening. So what happens for numbers that are bigger? Let's take an even number that's bigger than 46. What that's doing is because it keeps adding 2, it can never reach 46. Okay, so that was the right answer was all numbers that are smaller than 46. Okay, any questions about this one? Okay, so let's recap a little bit about compression. Actually, I added a few things about it because there's a lot of practical problems that you know we kind of deal with every day that you use compression. And so last time we talked about compressing text and basically trying to take every character of a text and make it as small as possible in terms of bits, in terms of how much information we use. We can also compress images or videos. So if you have a camera, it has a lot of settings that, you know, compress the images. Maybe if you have, 10 megapixels or something like that, it doesn't actually make huge images, even though it could, because it has all the settings that compress the images. And so the way it happens is that, taking this image, the program goes into the image and kind of tries to find areas that have the same color.
And so it finds these areas, and it doesn't need to store the information about each pixel. This pixel has this color, this pixel has this color, and so on. It just needs to remember what the color is, and then basically the edges of that region. And so that saves a lot of information. And then what happens is, I'm not sure if you can see the difference, but this is more blurry. So some compression makes it look very, like it's made out of blocks, just because of that. Because it takes, you know, each region and it approximates it with a block. This one though, what this one is, the reason why it's blurry is because it basically only remembers for each region, it remembers a color, and then it kind of tries to make it look natural by, you know, making all the pixels not exactly the same color, but very close colors. And so then it gets blurry, the edges are not so clear in the image. Because it does this approximating, each pixel is going to approximate the color of the neighboring pixels. And so, we might not see, the way I did this, I made this image very small, and then I made it bigger. And so, you know, if the image is smaller, you're not going to be able to see the difference, but if the image is bigger, you're going to actually be able to see the blocks. And so, compression works if you have a small image. If you have a poster, you're going to be able to see that the quality is not so good. And so another way to compress it is, if you have a drawing like this, you can just remember the lines of, this drawing is made out of this line, which looks like this, and this line, which looks like this, and then I can just remember a series of lines, and then I can store in a small, with a small amount of data, and then I can retrieve it if I want to. And so also for pictures, pictures with colors, you can remember a list of regions. This region has this color, this region has this color, and so on. And so can make it very small. Any type of anything that's regular in an image, in a text, can be taken advantage of and compressed. So basically, perfectly compressed, texts that are compressed well are not going to have any irregularities in them. And so that's one idea. Another video compression happens also a lot. The digital, Netflix has this. We can watch their movies online or things like that. And so basically, you connect to the Netflix server and then it sends you the movie. And so it needs to be compressed because, you don't have all the time in the world to, download the movie. And so sometimes their macro blocking happens. I don't know if you've ever seen this. So in a video, you're going to see, a whole area being just a block instead of being a nice natural image. So, for example, kind of video here. This is, I think, news from. I just looked natural blocking on YouTube, and so see, like all these blocks. You can totally see the blocks. So basically, a whole region is approximated by by just one color, when it's actually not just one color. And I think it gets bad like later. And also, it's this delay in. Normally a movie is made out of frames. It's about 24 frames per second. If they want to compress it, they can say, well, this frame is kind of like this frame, so we're just going to, instead of sending, three frames, we're just going to send one. And so you get this delay in, that's pretty bad. You get this delay in the movie, in people, the way people move, or, so you can see that it's almost, you can't even tell what it is. All right. So that's about video. Again, we talked about Huffman coding. Before we do clicker questions on it, I just wanted to run over an example. We did this in class last time. The way you compress a word is that you basically count, or a text, you basically count
how many times does each letter show? And so you write down the counts for each letter. M appears one time, I appears four times, P appears two times, and S appears four times. And then you write them all down, and you select, at each step, you select the two smallest frequencies. And so here, they're one and two. You make a little small tree, and you call that three because that's the sum of the two frequencies. The next smallest are three and four, and the next smallest are 7 and 11. And so once you build this tree, you go, you find the code for each word, for each letter, by going from the root of the tree down until you reach that that letter. And if you take a left, if you make a left, you're going to call that a zero. If you make a right, you're going to call that a one. And so basically these are the codes for the letters. The code for M is 000 because you go left from the root, you go left to reach M, and so on. The I is 01. And the total number of bits is how many bits you need to represent M. You need 3 bits. How many M's do you have? You have 1 M. Plus how many bits you need for P. You need 3 bits for P. And there's 2 P's. You need 2 bits for, I think this is I. And there you have 4 I's and so on. And the total is 81. If you do the ASCII normal, you know, 8-bit you know, codes, you would get, you know, 11 letters times 8, 88. And so this is a very good compression. Great. I think I want to mention something else here. Any questions? So you don't necessarily need, at any step when you decide the smallest frequencies, it doesn't need to be something that's already built and adding something to it. It can just be, you know, these two or something like that. So just always choose the two smallest frequencies in the tree. All right? Yeah.
How do you get 4 for I from 2?
You have 4 I's because you count all the I's.
Yeah, but why? Does it matter when you draw it? Does, like, it's not adding up to 4, it's only adding up to 2? Like, do you have to add up any of the sides when you do that?
Are you talking about this 4? This is the four that comes from counting just how many.
I understand.
Okay.
That, but when you do the triangle, like what does that mean? Like, I don't understand.
Okay, so how when we added the four, when you added the I to it? All right. So what we did was we had a tree that had frequency 3 and 2 that had 4. And what are the two smallest ones? Well, it's going to be the 3 and one of the 4s. And so you choose that and you make a tree and you, on top of the tree, you write, you know, some of the frequencies between, you know, the two trees that you connected. How do you get 4 here? So it's easier to, like, sum up. Okay. Any other questions? No? Oh, yeah. Oh, you got what? The 21 here? Okay, so I'm saying, okay, how many bits do I need to represent M? I need 3 bits. Because my code is 000, right? And so how many M's do I have? I have 1 M. So all the M's are going to take 3 bits. What about all the P's? Well, I have 2 P's, and I need 3 bits to represent a P. So I'm going to need 6, and so on. So I just need, add them all up. You can write down the code for Mississippi and count it if you want to. Yeah.
How do you come up with the code? Like, is it always, like, 0 on the outside of the tree and then 1 on the inside?
I wouldn't say outside and inside. I would say left and right. So this is actually, doesn't look like a, so I start here. This doesn't look like the root of the tree, but I start here, and then how do I reach the letter? Do I take the left branch or do I take the right branch? Okay. As I look at it, not as I would drive or something.
Okay.
So then do I take the left range? I say 0. Then I take the right range. I say 1. And that 0, 1 is a code for I.
And it's always that type of setup?
Yeah. Other questions? No? OK, so this is your word. Adriana Lima. And so using a Huffman code, how many bits do you need to encode that word? And your options are 829, 830, C31, D32, E33. There's like individual letters that have the smallest frequencies, you choose those. I'm sorry? Okay, what if they're equal? It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. zero left, one right. Actually, it doesn't matter, but you need to be consistent.
All right.
But yeah, zero to the left, one to the right. I shouldn't have said that. Sorry? Yeah, you, it doesn't matter. You're not all going to come up with the same code. Yep. For code to be zero, just zero?
For one letter?
Yes.
Right.
If it's the most frequent one. Then you're something else. I mean, if there's just two letters, it's going to be... I'm done. Stop at, I think that's an 8:30, so 30 seconds. No? Okay then. Give it more time. Okay, I'm gonna stop.
I'm waiting for you then.
Yeah, add one vote to A, my vote, but I'm gonna do it on the. Yeah, but the number of bits is. That's why I asked how many bits. So here's what I got, and then you can yell at me, you know, I did something wrong. So A And A has 4, B has 1, R has 1, I has 2, N, there's 1 N, there's 1 L, and there's 1 M. Everybody agree at this point? Cool. All right, so then I said...
So there's 2 N's.
This is M. Right? Okay. D has 1, M, L. I ordered this this way to make it look pretty, but okay. 1, 1, and I is 2. Okay. And so what I did, I ordered N and L. That's a 2. Then the next small ones are, I have three more ones, so I grouped M and R to be a 2. Now the smallest one is 1, and then I choose one of the 2s. And I chose D. I grouped it with this one. That's a 3. Now my smallest ones are these 2, because this is a 2 and this is a 2. 4. Now I have a 3 and 2 4s, so it doesn't matter which 4 I choose. And I chose A and this one to make a 7. And then I chose these two to make 11. Okay, so that's my trick. And so I don't even need to assign codes, but I will assign codes, but I don't need to assign codes at this point. I can just say, okay, the number of bits I need for A is 2. 1, 2. And so I'm going to need 8 bits for A, all the A's. I'm going to need 1, 2, 3 bits for D. But I'm going to assign codes. So codes are, I'm going to put zeros on the left branches. And I'm going to put ones on the right branches. And so for every character, I'm going to assign the code. Going from the root, I'm going left and left for A, so 0, 0. And you probably should have gotten, well, it doesn't matter. How many people got one bit code for A? Okay, that's fine. D will be 0, 1, 0. R will be 1, 0, 1. Okay. I will be 1, 1. Then I have N. N will be 0, 1, 1, 0. Then L is 0, 1, 1, 1. And M is 1, 0, 0. Okay. And so now I'm adding up all the bits. So I have 4 I's times 2 plus 1 D times 3 plus 1 R times 3 plus 2 I's times 2, plus 1 N times 4, plus 1 L times 4, plus 1 M times 3. Okay, so I have math. Okay. So this is a 3, this 3 and this 3 and this 4 give me a 10. Then I have an 8 and a 3, which give me 11, 8, 29. Yeah? No?
You should add them up.
29.
Okay. All right then. So it's 29, okay? Anybody who got a different answer want to tell us where what went wrong or where they... It's hard to tell because you get such different codes, but the total number is going to be the same. How
like my more range.
I can take a look at it.
Okay, next question is about walking in Manhattan again. So this time you start here, you go all the way up, and then you go down this way, along the diagonal. How far did you go as a function of n? What is that like? Is that like big O of log n? Is that like big O of n? Is it big O of n log n? Is it big O of n squared, or is it big O of 1? Big O of 1 means just a constant. No matter, it doesn't depend on n. And I'm going to start. Stop at 120. The right answer. And the reason why is because I'm just gonna count how many blocks I'm walking. So I'm walking n blocks when I walk this way. And then what happens? Then this weird thing happens, right? So this weird thing, how many blocks is that? For every square on this side, I walk two blocks. I walk two blocks for this square. I walk two blocks for this square. I walk two blocks for this square, or for this block. And so for every block on this edge, I walk two blocks. So that gives me a total number of 2n, right? So let's see, here I have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 blocks on this side. How many blocks do I walk this way? I walk 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. So I walk two times n, twice the size of how many streets I have, for example. And so I have n and then 2n. So n plus 2n is 3n. So that's big O of n. Any questions?
Let's try another one.
This is how I walk this time. I start here again, and I walk like this until up to this point, and then I stop. And this point is exactly 3 blocks this way and 2 blocks this way. Okay? So I need to walk, how many blocks do I need to walk again as a function of n? All right, is that clear how I walk? And what happens? No? Okay, so I start here, and then I walk up to this point, but this point is 3 blocks. The distance between here and here is 3 blocks, and the distance between here and here is 2 blocks. And the question is, how many blocks do I walk as a function of n?
Is that like one time? Or?
So how many blocks do I walk, basically? Can you tell me how many blocks I walk? Can you count that? How many?
1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Is that a function of n?
Like, no matter how big this is going to stay constant, the distance, right? I have a fixed, you know, this can go, like, you know, this city can be infinitely long and infinitely high, or, you know, have infinite number of blocks and, you know, avenues and streets, but I will have, you know, I will have to walk only 5 blocks. So it doesn't depend. It's a constant of n, right? So now you have to choose the answer. A million, that means that it's like a million. It's like 2 million, 5 million. Okay? That's big O of n. If it's a trillion blocks, if n is a trillion, it's gonna be like a trillion. It's gonna be 2 trillion, 5 trillion. Okay. Just so you know, that's what big O of n means. Which means a constant, because no matter how big this city is, I will only walk 5 blocks. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. This is fixed, this is fixed, it's not a function of n. So, yeah, it's a constant, okay? Interesting topic is encryption, which is I want to send a secret code between, I want to send a secret code to somebody. How do I make it secret? How does that work? And we talked a little bit about that for quantum, when we talked about quantum computers and how encryption is based on the fact that, you know, you have large numbers that are very hard to be factored. And so if you did the math to break the passwords, it would take about 1,000 years or so with, you know, with computers that we have right now, and so it's not really worth doing the job. And so that's what it's based on. It's based on factoring very large prime numbers. And so, for example, if a person wants to buy a laptop online, she goes to the online store, and she says, "I want to buy a laptop," and then she chooses it. And then they ask what's her credit card number. And so, if she says this number, I really hope this is not a real number. If she says this number and somebody's maybe, you know, watching her, you know, there's all kinds of ways of it's called to listen to the, you know, eavesdropping or something like that. They can see that credit card number and they can steal her identity or something like that. And so what she does is, she basically puts her credit card number in a box and locks the box and sends the box on the network to the online store. And so the online store needs to have the key, the same key that this person used to lock the box. And so it's not actually a locking of something in a box. It's something that has to do with bits, which we're going to see in a little bit. But, you know, if this is locked, the person is not going to be able to see what's, you know, the credit card number. And so that's good. The problem is that they both need to have the same key. And so, you know, this person somehow needs to give the key to the store website. And usually that's not how things happen for online shopping. And so, yeah, that's the end of the story. So what the key is, it's just a sequence of bits. And the way it works is, say this person wants to, encrypt this message. You know, so this is an 8-bit key. It has an 8-bit number. And so the way it works is that this being the message, wherever the key for each bit, whatever the key is, bit is 1, that's going to switch the bit of the locked message. Okay, so you know, you had this bit was 1, so this bit is going to change into 0. This bit was 0, so this bit will stay the same. This bit is 1, so this one will change into a 0, and so on. And so for every 1 bit that is 1 in the key, you are going to switch the bits in the message. And so if somebody sees this message or listens to the line or they can't tell which bits have been switched and which bits haven't been switched. And the reverse process is very easy, because if this is a lock message, which is this one, you can use exactly the same key and exactly the same process to get the original message. And so, because for each bit of the key that was switched, you're going to know that that bit was switched and retrieve your message from. And this is how the most basic function of all encryption systems. And so the way online stores work is that the online store has a public key, and the online store is Bob and the user is Alice. And so actually it's the opposite. I'm sorry. So the online store has a public key, and so Bob can encrypt the message using the public key, and the only key that unlocks the message is the private key of the store. And so if I want to send the store my credit card number, I have, the key of the store is online anywhere, but only the store can unlock the message. And so it's not, the same key locks and unlocks. One key unlocks, the other key, one key locks, the other key unlocks. And so that's the public key. Now, also, I want to say something like, I will pay $500 and I want to sign it. And I want, how does a signature work? You've probably heard of digital signatures. And the way that works is that I sign something. I make a commitment or whatever, that I'll pay $500. I lock it with my private key. And then anybody in the world knows my public key, and so they can unlock it. And the only key that unlocks the message that I locked with my private key is the public key. Okay. So this is not the way we think about keys. But I could not unlock the message using the private key, but just the public key, which is available to anybody. And so this is how digital signature is used. Then we also have, if I want to have a secret conversation with somebody, I don't know their private keys, obviously. I just know their public keys, and so I use their public keys. So I use, if I'm Alice, I'll use Bob's public key and my private key to lock it. And what's going to unlock it is going to be the same combination of keys. And so these keys, again, are set up in such a way that these things work. So, whatever I can lock with these two keys, I can also unlock with these two keys. And, there's a whole bunch of math that I'm sure you probably don't want to know. If you want to know, there's stuff online about it. But it's just very, very interesting in this whole issue of privacy. And so this is encryption. And then there's also stuff like, you have, satellites are sent out to outer space, deep space probes, which send, information back to Earth. And, things happen, things go wrong. There's an error, there's a message sent, and there's errors in the message. And so we want to figure out, has there been errors in the transmission. And so there's two kinds of code. There's error detection, which the code can tell us there has been an error. We don't know what happened, what was wrong. And so we can ask them to send the message again. Or then there's also error correction code, which actually, you know, give us exactly the information that we need to correct the code. And so those would be more efficient, because if we send a signal at this distance, that takes a long time, and so we would like to know, to correct it too. And so the way, you know, how do I know that something's gone wrong? Well, I can just ask the person to send a message twice. And so if the message is the same message, and if the messages are different, then I'm going to know that something went wrong. But I'm not going to know what went wrong. And so if they send it three times, you know, I'm going to take a majority, and, you know, if two of them are the same, I'm going to assume that that was the right message and there was an error just once. There's also a parity bit, which can be used, which is actually what most codes have. And the way that works is, instead of having 8 bits, we said that, you know, computers operate with 8 bits at a time. Instead of having 8 bits, I only have 7, and I reserve the 8th bit to be, you know, if there's an even number of 1s, that 8th bit is going to be 1. If there's an odd number of 1s, I'm going to make that bit 0. And so if, say, this bit has been changed from 1 to 0, and this is what I'm getting, I'm going to say 1, 2, 3, I have 4 ones, and so this should be 1, and so something went wrong. And so I'm going to know that, you know, there's an error in this message, and I can ask the other person to send it again. But if there's 2 bits that change, this becomes 3 ones, so this will be, I'm not going to be able to tell that there's an error. So basically this only works with an odd number of errors. If there's an even number of errors, that doesn't go right. You can also have error correction, and this is pretty cool. So, you know, if you have data, say, grouped into 9 bits, and you have this is the first bit, this is the second bit, third bit, and you have parity bits, which say, okay, this parity bit here is going to be 1 if an even number of these 3 bits are 1. And this parity bit will be 1 if an even number of these bits are going to be 1. This parity bit is going to be even if one of these bits. And then this one is going to be responsible for these 3, and so on. So you have all the rows and all the columns. And so, you know, this is an example of that. So, you know, for this column, we have 2 ones. So we have this bit is going to be 1. For this column, we have 1 1, so it's going to be 0, and so on. And so if something goes wrong with that, say this becomes a 0, what you're going to know, you're going to say that, okay, this column is okay, right? We have, you know, the parity bit agrees with the information. This column is okay, and this column is not okay, because I have an odd number of 1s, and this parity bit is 1. And so I know that the error occurred on the third column. And then I go to, right, and then I go to the first line, and I say, okay, this is not okay either. And so I know exactly where, I know the row and the column of the bit that is wrong, and because it's a 0, I know it's going to be a 1, and so I don't need the person to send me the message again. And so this is an error correction code, which, you know, I can figure it out. Also, there's always one error in the data will give me 2 parity bit errors. What happens if one of the parity bits is going to be wrong? Well, in that case, say this bit is 0, I'm going to have an error here, but I'm not going to have an error here. And so if the error is in the parity bit, that only gives me 1 parity error. And so I know exactly, you know, if the error is in the data or if the error is in the parity bit, so I know I can detect any error in this code and correct it. Yeah?
Wouldn't 2 data errors... Well, okay, I guess it would cancel out the parity error on the left, but it would create a second one on the top.
Yeah.
Okay, never mind.
Okay. All right. So this is how, you know, errors are corrected, and something like this is probably used between communication between deep space probes and the Earth. I think that's secret information, but, you know, this is pretty robust and pretty good. Okay, and so today we're going to start talking about parallel computers, and I think we're going to finish next time. And so the main idea is that, you know, we want computers to be faster and faster and faster. And so, you know, that's what computers, you know, technology has worked on for the past, you know, couple of decades. And so This is a graph that shows how many transistors are on a chip, have been on a chip for Intel processors. And so this is a logarithmic scale. So actually this is an exponential graph. So you see this is 1,000, it doesn't grow linearly. This is 1,000, this is 10,000, 100,000. So it, you know, this number is 10 times bigger than this number, this number is 10 times bigger than this number. And so this is actually an exponential growth, but it's very hard to capture that because it grows so fast, and so they took the log and they plotted it here. And so you can see that just how this has grown. It's grown, it's basically doubled every 18 months since 1970, in a sense. And so, you know, that means that, you know, the computers are, so there's more and more and more transistors, right? And so, you know, it eventually needs to stop because this light, you know, it's limited by the speed of light. You know, light can only travel this fast. It only can travel by, so a foot per nanosecond. Nanosecond is a billionth of a second. And so, because information cannot travel faster, these, you know, the number of chips is the number of transistors on a chip is actually going to stop at some point. And so this growth is, you know, will stop. And so, you know, there's prediction about, you know, somewhere between 2010 and 2020. And so what can they do to make computers faster, though? You know, like we need to figure out a different way to make to make computers faster. Okay, and so what what they do is, okay, what if we had you know, multiple computers working together to accomplish the same task? And so, you know, if you have multiple hands working on the same task, that's going to make it, you know, go the task, you know, go faster. And so the thing is, you know, this is the idea of a parallel computer, right? It's multiple computers working together on the same task. And so the thing is, the parallel computers were very big in the 1960s. Then they became less popular because of some problems that, you know, people have pointed out. And then now they're becoming fast again because problems now are so much bigger. There's so much more, you know, there's Google, which is huge, you know, amounts of data that you can process in parallel. And so they're really getting, you know, it's a hot topic again. And so this is a computer in 1989. Hillis is the author of that book that I showed you that, you know, was used in this class before. He used it to actually model fluid dynamics. So, you want to predict what a stream of water or any kind of fluid will do and how it will act. And so there's a lot of operations. And so he created this really big and really cool looking computer. It's like 8 blocks connected together. And so he won this prize for this really, really strong, you know, big computer, very impressive at the time, which did perform 3.1 billion operations per second. Now, I think one of the latest single processor computers, the single Mac G5, which is, you know, after 21 years, just one processor can do 2.5 billion cycles per second and is really not a big deal. And so you can go to the mall and buy it. And so, you know, sometimes the best way to solve a problem, as somebody was saying, is just wait 17 years until the computers are going to be more powerful, and then you're going to be able to do it fast. But this is to show how, you know, how much... I looked up how, you know, what Intel processors were back then, how fast they were. They were 50 megahertz, which is basically it doubled 15 times since the speed doubled 15 times since 1989, which is, you know, I was alive in 1989. It's kind of crazy. Okay. And so, you know, also Google, that's the idea that they use. They have tons and tons and tons of computers that work together. And, you know, people have tried to predict how many computers Google has. They won't tell you. But, you know, based on the financial reports that Google has given, they estimated around 300,000 computers, which is kind of crazy to even start to imagine. And so, you know, it might be 100,000, it might be around that, it doesn't, you know, but they estimate it to just a lot of computers. And so, and also, each of those computers is a very, very powerful computer. You know, it's just the same, the power that, you know, a computer that you would have probably has. And so, and there's also lots of them. And so, you know, people have been finding a problem in, you know, in the past, in the 60s, they were saying, okay, well, you know, what about if we, you know, if J.K. Rowling took two years to write the last Harry Potter book? What if we hire 600 authors, and they will together work, and we'll finish it in 10 days, maybe, or something? And so, would that work? Well, we know that wouldn't work, because it would be totally disconnected, it wouldn't make any sense, and it wouldn't be an interesting story. So, you know, this kind of problem cannot be broken into a lot of tasks. And so there's a lot of problems like that, which cannot be, you know, you can't break every problem into smaller tasks and, like, have a lot of computers work on it. So, you know, if you had, you know, 600 authors, you would basically get this kind of log, you know, reduction of the problem, which is a very good reduction. And so, but you need to coordinate, so between them. So either you have all of them talk together and brainstorm, which would take a lot of time, and they wouldn't agree, and so it would be kind of messy. And so that's a better solution to this problem. And so another problem is that, you know, you have two processors and memory. These are processors and memory. And so memory, you know, maybe the two processors work at the same time, but memory still cannot access more than one location at a time. You can't ask it, you know, give me two numbers. You know, I have to ask it, give me one number, and then give me another number. And it's pretty slow already. And so for a lot of problems, the processors end up waiting for the memory to respond. And so, you know, it's not very efficient that way. So that's one problem. The other problem is that, you know, what happens if, for example, you know, two different processors want to make a reservation, like airline ticket reservations. And so let's say, you know, there's a spot that's free, and so they both see that there's a spot that's free, and so they both reserve the same seat. What happens then? That's a problem. And so, you know, they have to go through this whole, you know, one processor locks the reservation and then waits for it. It's a very complicated protocol that they go through, and which kind of slows it down too. And the last problem is that, you know, if you divide the tasks between the processors, one task is still going to be a slower task than the other tasks. And so, you know, maybe this processor is working on the slow task, and the other processors are going to still have to wait for the slowest task to be done. And so, you know, that processor will slow down the system to do. But So today, though, most problems that we have can be solved by using parallel computers. And so, you know, some examples are, you know, when you want to process an image, if you have a big poster with a lot of pixels and you want to make it black and white, you can just assign a region of the image to one processor, and each will do a small part of the image. And so, you know, playing chess is also, they use parallel computers because, you know, when you have, you probably know this, computers, when the computers play chess, they actually, you know, try all the possible moves and, you know, try to move as far as they can. It's a very big state space. There's a lot of possibilities. But, you know, you can assign one trajectory, one way things can work to each processor. And so you can use them to do that. You can also sum up numbers in a list, and we're going to see how that goes. And so here's the task of painting a fence. And so you have fence, and this task can be broken into a few tasks. So one is to open the paint cans. You can prepare the surfaces. You need to apply the paint, and you can clean the brushes. How would you, if you have 10 people, how would you assign... How would you assign the tasks to each person so that this would work fast, or as fast as possible, or maybe not even fast? Just how would you do it? How would you, if you're the boss and you pay them, for example? and you want to be done. You want to be done at some point. It doesn't have to be super brilliant. Yeah. Go ahead.
I guess you have like a couple guys like setting up the table, measuring out the sizes, right? Lining it up, and then the other guy, like getting all this color stuff ready, like painting.
Mm-hmm.
All there. Like, painting while one guy's still building the other one.
Yep. Right. Your name is Christopher, right? So what Christopher is saying is that you can have a few people take care of this, then you can have a few people take care of this, right? Then you can have a few people take care of this, and you can have few people take care of this. And that is a good way to do it, and that will speed things up a little bit, but you might still, if something takes a long time, you might still wait for the person who does the slowest task. You know, say, you know, preparing the surface, it takes a long time. And then, you know, say it takes double the time for, you know, compared to all the other teams. You're still going to have to wait for them to do it. Any other ideas? Yeah. Yeah, and you can probably do that to, so I don't know if everybody heard, he said that you cannot just assign more people to the task that takes the longest. And so I think you can do that and assign it dynamically and reach an optimal way of doing it. What the parallel computers do or would do is, so that is actually what Christopher was saying, is that is you divide the tasks, so you divide each group of processors to one task, a group of processors to a different task, and so you have, it's called instruction parallelism. So you parallelize the tasks. One way you can do it is you can have, you know, 10 people divide the fence in 10 regions, and if one person does all the tasks for that region. And that will make it, if everybody's approximately the same speed, that will make it that will make it the fastest possible. And so this is called data parallelism. And so this way every processor does the same thing, but they divide the data. They divide the fence that they need to paint among themselves. And so, all right, let's do this, and then we'll be done for the day. So I want you all to think about your phone number. And raise your hand if there are at least 2 5s in your phone number. Okay. So I have 1, 2, 3, 4. I'm not going to try to guess your phone number. 5. Okay, so I have 5 people. Notice how fast that... Oh, 6. Sorry. Okay, so notice how fast that took, right? One option would be the way, you know, an algorithm would do it, would be, you know, everybody write your phone number on a piece of paper, everybody give me your paper, I would go over every phone number and look, oh, is there 2 5s? No. Is there 2 5s? Yes. And I would count them. But this way, it was instant. It was basically, you know, everybody had their phone number and everybody worked on their phone. You each were a processor and your data was your phone number. And you each worked on your data, and it was just a really fast answer. And so, all right, I'm done for today. Thanks.